Hi, Ron Warren here. Recently, Cosmopolitan magazine published an open letter from a woman who was about to abort her baby. Going by the initial H, she addressed her letter to her unborn child, Little Thing. In short, the expectant mother tells her unborn child that because she is not ready to be a mother yet, she's going to have an abortion. She assures her child that they will meet again when she's ready for motherhood. You can read the full letter at the link we provide below. There are several statements in the letter that, frankly, are incredibly disturbing. But first, I want to make it clear that we should have compassion for this mother. Yes, what she did was wrong. Yes, she's being illogical. Yes, she has taken a life. But she is a product of our fallen culture and a fallen world. You see, for the past 50 years, we have built a culture that says sex and marriage are not connected. There are no absolutes. There is no truth separate and distinct from what you feel or believe. With that cultural mindset in place, how can we expect anything other than what this mother wrote? So as Christians, we are called to meet her and others like her with compassion, hope, and help, just like Jesus did. With that spirit in mind, I want to point out the elements of this letter that should cause us all to step back and rethink some things. First, H writes to her baby that they will meet again in this world, not the next. By writing that, she has stripped away her child's uniqueness and identity. The next time she gets pregnant, she will bring into life another little one, not a little thing, that is not the same one that she aborted. Every human life has its own unique DNA. The DNA that made up that little one who was aborted will never again be reproduced. He or she is lost forever to this world. But this mom has created a narrative that I suspect has its roots in two things. First and foremost, I believe that H was seeking moral justification for her act by convincing herself that she's not actually killing her baby, but putting off its birth to a later date. And in a culture where science fiction storylines about alternate realities and universes have become very popular, she could find plenty of theories to support her notion that their paths would cross again in some other reality. Thus, her statement in the letter, "I promise that the next time I see that little blue plus, the next time you are in the same reality as me, I will be ready for you." Another part of the letter that I found disturbing was the following, and I quote, "Love and spontaneity are beautiful, but they have little merit." Love has little merit? One of the most famous Bible verses of all times is 1 Corinthians 13:13, which says, "Three things will last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love." Love is the basis and foundation of family life. It is the basis of our relationship with God, who is love. To dismiss love as meritless is again a sad product of a culture that appears to not want people to be in loving relationships with each other or with God. Love makes things complicated. It commits people to each other. It requires self-sacrifice. Therefore, love's enemies would say that it limits freedom. It limits our ability to spread our wings and self-actualize. Love is related to old-fashioned things like marriage and monogamy. In a culture of people who have broken free of those chains, we can't have things like love floating around. Therefore, we have created a loveless culture that no longer knows the value of love. Again, folks, this is a culture we created, and this young woman is a product of it. The final point I want to make is the way in which H reflects a growing sentiment in the pro-choice movement. More and more, we are seeing pro-choice people fully acknowledging the humanity of the babies they are aborting. But they still feel justified because they view that life as a life worth sacrificing. H makes this clear in her statement, "I want you to be better than I ever was." In other words, my aborting you is the compassionate thing to do because you are better off not being born. This is a scary turning point in our culture. While horrific, at least there was logic to the pro-choice position of the past, which said, it's not a life, therefore aborting it is a morally neutral act. But the new argument we face is much scarier. It is a life, but a life worth sacrificing. This is vice masquerading as virtue. It is killing dressed up in sanitized terms like choice and reproductive freedom. How do we argue with someone who knows they're ending a life but believes they are making a compassionate moral choice? And as I've discussed in previous life chats, this is exactly the mentality used by history's greatest villains. Slavery, the Holocaust, and other atrocities were always committed by people who believed the lives they were destroying were in fact lives, but lives worth sacrificing for a greater moral, social, or economic good. I feel the pro-choice movement has committed fully to this ideology. Therefore, it is up to us as pro-abundant life people to tell a different story and provide the compassion, hope, and help women and men need to make life-affirming choices. You know, Cosmopolitan published this letter under a headline that said that H's letter was heartwarming. I'm sorry, folks, but this letter is heartbreaking. And indeed, we have much work to do. Amen? Until next time, may God bless you daily as you serve Him faithfully.
Good morning, everyone. So that was a live chat. And, you know, we do these, I guess, at least once a month, sometimes more, but no slides down. No slides yet. Okay. No slides. As in, no slides. There should be no slide.
Take the slide down.
Anyway, don't pay attention to the slide because there's no slide. All right. Right, good. I'll let you guys know when the slides come up. Anyway, so we do these monthly, and it's really one of the ways that we're just trying to get more and more information out to you about what's happening in the culture, what's happening at CareNet, things that certainly you guys can be thinking about, praying about, and things of that nature. And also, I'll just say real quickly, if you have ideas of other things that we should talk about, just shoot us an email. Vince and I and the team, we'll kind of research and try to figure it out. We try to make these things short and sweet. So if you're not getting them, I hope that you'll start getting them. Anyway, so today is my last talk at the conference. Won't be seeing a lot of you guys for a year. It may be longer for some. But I wanted to spend this last session I have talking about something that Meg talked about a little bit. She talked about the whole notion about greatness and being great. And what does it mean to be great? You know, I grew up in the 70s, and this was right during the prime of boxer Muhammad Ali. And as some of you probably recall, and probably mostly at this point, recall that he would call himself the greatest. Not just the great boxer, but simply the greatest. In fact, in 1977, Ali produced a movie which was titled Ali, and was titled The Greatness. And of course, Ali starred as himself, the greatest. So, you know, some time ago, I came across an article, and the article was written, you know, during the time when Ali was sort of declining in health. I think he was 72 at the time, and he was afflicted by Parkinson's disease. And the article chronicled a rumble in his personal jungle, a big conflict in his family. You see, Ali had 9 children with 4 different women. And to quote the article, it says, "While he was an amazing showman and had the courage of a lion in the ring, when it came to his private life, his morals were more those of an alley cat. The way he treated his first 3 wives and neglected some of his 9 children was frankly disgraceful. His son, who has plainly suffered the consequences of his loose behavior, theorizes that it was inherited from his grandfather, who was, as he says, serially unfaithful to his grandmother, Odessa." Quoting the son, it says, "It was like the song, 'Papa was a rolling stone,' he told me. When it came to women, my daddy and my grandpa weren't very nice people. They were whores." Ali's son goes on to say, "My daddy would sometimes drop by with a fistful of dollars, but I didn't see him very much after he and my mother split up. I used to get picked on at school," he says, removing his glasses to show his broken nose. "Kids wanted to box me because I was Ali's son." I think he wished later in life he had paid more attention. At his 50th birthday party, when Ali Jr. was 19, he took me aside and we had our only heart-to-heart. He told me that he was afraid what would happen to him in the afterlife because of some of the things that he had done. I told him I still loved him. His eyes filled with tears. The greatest. You know, when you float like a butterfly in and out of your children's lives, and your indifference and neglect, in many cases for them, stings like a bee. Indeed, children are wired from the womb to know that a father's most valuable, most precious, and most irreplaceable asset is his time. And, you know, I've said often and read many, many places that kids spell love, T-I-M-E. They need more than just the periodic fistful of cash and presents. They need an embrace and presence. They need to connect to him physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And in the young lives of Ali's children, it certainly appears that there were times when he didn't respond to the bell for some of them. That said, I suspect, like many prodigal fathers, in his later years, Ali attempted to find his way home to repair the damage he had done to the children he had neglected. And this is a good thing. But a father's absence, even when he repents and attempts to repair the damage done, leaves visible and invisible scars and holes in wounded souls of children, even into adulthood. So it's best for fathers and mothers, for that matter, to treat the fragile young ones that God entrusts to them with care. Amen? And you know, it's an interesting thing, you know, because if you saw that movie in 1977, the theme song for that movie was The Greatest Love of All, which obviously he certainly approved. And there's a key verse in that song said, I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed, at least I live as I believe. The greatest. Now, I'm not saying these things to shame the dead. Indeed, we all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. I'm really trying to say these to inspire us, the living, and for us to really think about and consider what it means to be great. I mean, truly means to be great. And it's interesting, but not surprising. The Bible has something to say about greatness. There's a passage in Mark chapter 9, verse 33 through 37. I'll read it for you. It says, then they came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last, the servant of all. Then he took a small child whom he placed among them. Taking the child into his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me. So let's unpack that a little bit. In terms of what happened, you have the disciples there, and they're walking along the road, and they're arguing about who is the greatest. Now, here's the thing. Jesus didn't chastise them for wanting to be great or tell them that they should not want to be great. After all, each and every one of us is created in the image of a great God. So we should want to be great. In fact, we're called to be great. There is greatness in us. We are made for greatness. They were made for greatness. We're all made for greatness. It's in our nature. It's in you. It's in me. It's in our DNA. We're designed to be great. But look what Jesus did. He defined greatness for them. He said, if you want to be first, that is the greatest, you must be the servant of all. In other words, he linked greatness to the service of others. And he didn't stop there. He took a little child who was standing by and brought that little child into their midst. And the emphasis here really is little, in my view. The little child. Heck, I believe if there was an ultrasound there that was available at that time, and there was a pregnant woman there available at that time, that he would have taken the ultrasound and showed them the little one inside to make his point. He would have used whatever, whomever was in the midst and was the most vulnerable. Now, when you think about children, especially during that time, and especially for men, they were considered very lowly, often marginalized and overlooked in the culture. They were vulnerable. Someone that you didn't pay much attention to, You know, they were barely seen and never heard. But Jesus said, unless you receive and care for a child, that is the lowly and the vulnerable, you weren't great. So he linked greatness to service of others and said that the more vulnerable the others that you serve, the greater you are. Now, this was really pretty shocking for them. They were living in the time of Herod, King Herod, who called himself Herod the Great. And this was a guy who had built lots of fortresses and palaces and monuments to his greatness. But when it came to people, he was very harsh. He even killed three of his own children. And when Jesus was born, he tried to kill Jesus, too, because he felt that and knew that Jesus' birth would be a challenge and threat to his vision and his definition of greatness. In fact, since he didn't know where Jesus was, he ordered his men to kill all the babies that were born at that time just to make sure. You see, Herod's measure for greatness was very different from Jesus. For him, it was all about his individual plans, his pleasures, his purposes, above all else, about his life. It was all about him. Now, we live in a culture that is increasingly defining greatness the way that Herod did. We see this on TV, in our music, in our offices, and sadly, sometimes even in our homes. It's all about me, all about my hustle, all about my stuff, about getting mine and taking yours. We're told that we should worship and glorify ourselves above all else. This is a constant drumbeat that says, it's all about me, it's all about me. Now, at CareNet, our work is to offer compassion, hope, and help as an alternative to abortion to women and men who face pregnancy decisions. And, you know, as I reflected on that passage I just read, it dawned on me that this really is a conversation about greatness. And the work that we do is really a conversation about greatness. You see, when a woman and a man enters an abortion clinic and meets the folks that want to assist them in taking the life of their unborn child, it's really a conversation about greatness. You see, these folks are vulnerable, challenged with a very difficult situation, and they're reminded of their hopes and their dreams. And the hopes and the dreams that they have for themselves, and often the hopes and dreams that they have for themselves as a couple and their lives together. And in a sense, the abortion doctor is saying, think about your future. Think about your plans. Don't you want to be great? Don't you want to do great things? Don't you want to be great? And because they're created in the image of God and everything inside of them says they're meant for greatness, they say, yes, yes, yes. I want to be great. I want to be great. And then they're told or they convince themselves that they want to be great and do great things and have great things. They can't do it with this baby. They need to put the child away, and too often, to millions of little ones in the womb, they do just that. And here's the thing. They're doing exactly the opposite of what Jesus said. See, they're following Herod's way. And that's why often when they come to their senses and realize what they've done, it's so painful for them. You know, there's a great book called Fatherhood Aborted, and there's a passage in there about a guy named Ricardo. And he said, every year on the anniversary of the abortion, I experience a terrible pain inside, thinking about the life that was lost, the home runs that will never be hit, the dance recitals that will never be. It's an ache in me. You see, Ricardo was robbed of an opportunity to be great. But here's the thing. And here's the good news for us and for your clients. We actually know which definition of greatness is the right definition of greatness. Jesus' definition or Herod's definition. Let me explain to prove the point. Let's say that there's a fireman. He has to go into a burning building. It's about to collapse and he only has time to save five people. So he rushes into the building, runs down a hallway, a smoky hallway. And there are two doors, one to the right and one to the left. And the one on the right says nursery, and he can hear five babies crying inside. And the door to the left says gym, and he can hear five bodybuilders grunting inside. So he has to make a decision quickly, and he does. He kicks the door in, rushes inside, he grabs the five bodybuilders, and he runs downstairs. Do you think he's going to get a hero's welcome? Do you think people are going to say what he did was a great thing? Is he going to be celebrated because of his greatness? And you know the answer is no. Why? Because he didn't save the most vulnerable. And his greatness was tied to this. And I think that, you know, this is why, you know, when Ali had his moment of clarity with his son, he was so troubled. You see, that's why when the culture gets it right, we make monuments to folks who do things like that. We give awards to folks who do things like that. Folks who sacrifice themselves for the vulnerable, not the powerful, to save themselves. So, you know, what does this have to do with us? I mean, you're tracking with me, I hope. It's got everything to do with us. You see, every day, you and your clients that you faithfully serve make decisions about greatness. You and they have a choice to define greatness the way that Jesus did, or to define greatness the way that Herod did. You see, with Jesus, he showed us that the great don't sacrifice the vulnerable for themselves like Herod did. They sacrifice themselves for the vulnerable. You know, I wrote this book called Bad Dads of the Bible, 8 Mistakes Every Good Dad Can Avoid. Shameless commercial here. You should buy it. I tell people all the time I had a ghostwriter, a holy ghostwriter. Anyway, you know, this book, again, is basically about greatness and the mistakes that fathers can make when they define greatness outside of God's design. And how all fathers can avoid making these mistakes. You see, after all, wise men and women learn from their mistakes, but the wisest learn from the mistakes of others. And I get inspired by that because, see, there's greatness in each and every one of us, and every one of the precious clients that you serve every day, regardless of their background, your background, income, past sins, obstacles in life, you and they were meant for greatness, truly greatness. So as you go from this place and you think about that, I want you to be thinking about it in the context of, I'm doing great things. And that God has put a greatness inside of me. And that I'm designed for greatness. And that you have the ability to demonstrate for all the clients that you serve what greatness looks like, what it feels like. They can learn the lessons from you. And it's interesting because, you know, the disciples, they obviously learned the lesson, didn't they? I mean, it's interesting because there are more children named Peter and John than Herod. So, as I sort of close up here a bit, I wanted to say, well, you know, okay, I'm talking about this broader concept of greatness. So, well, how do you do this in a practical sense? I mean, how do you kind of live this out in a practical way? So, why don't I give you a little model that, you know, I kind of thought about it a little bit that's been helpful to me as I think about my own life and the mistakes that I've made in my own life. Now you can put the slide up. There we go. So God gave me this insight that the path to greatness, that there are basically two keys in the path to greatness. One is that you pick the right path. And I'll unpack that a little bit for you. And the second thing is that you link discipline with desire. So you pick the right path and you link discipline with desire. Let's start with picking the right path. Now, what you see on the chart there is this notion of looking and longing. So one of the truisms of life for sure is that every key decision that we make or every choice that we make in life is preceded by two things, a looking and then a longing. You know, you look at in the direction where you want to take action or when you're considering something, and then you long. And longing is really this strong, persistent desire to get what you're looking at. Now, there's nothing wrong with looking and longing. Heck, that's how I got my wife. Nothing wrong with that. But here's the thing. Temptation. See, there's a tempter, an evil one, who seeks to influence what we're looking at and what we're longing for. Think about what happened to Eve and Adam with the fruit. It was pleasing to the eye and good for food. They were looking and longing, but the tempter was there. Pleasing to the eye and good for food. Now, of course, temptation is not sin, but there's a path that you can take that can lead you in that direction. And the reason we know that, of course, is because temptation existed before sin, right? So Satan existed before the sin ever occurred. And we also know that Jesus was tempted and yet did not sin. But there's a decision that you have to make, and it's a choice between a couple of different directions. See, the top path says you look and you long, and then you move on a path of loving and then living. And the bottom path says you look and you long, and then you move along a path of lusting and losing. Now, the thing that I've sort of figured out here, you know, certainly when you think about Scripture, you know, Proverbs 14:12 says, there is a way that appears right, but in the end leads to death. And the tempter and our own flesh is what makes a path seem right. You see, we can choose a path of loving and living, or we can choose the path of lusting and losing. And, you know, what is lusting? Well, lusting is an overmastering desire and an uncontrolled passion. It's a goal to satisfy self above all else. Now, if you think about your clients, this is why they're coming to see you. There was something that they looked at and longed for. This isn't just about sex. It's about a desire that you have. I want this guy to connect with me. I want unity and community. I want this. I'm looking at it. I'm longing for it. I want this. And then the question becomes, okay, what do you do with that? And it's interesting for me because when you're at that crossroad, you have a decision to make. You have to ask yourself a question. Who do you love? Who do you love? See, if you don't ask that question the right way, and if you don't ask that question of yourself, you could put yourself in a situation where instead of loving God and others, you're going to be focused so much on loving just yourself. So if you ask that question, the crossroad, I'm looking and I'm longing and I love only myself, then that's invariably going to lead you down the path of lusting and losing. But if you're at that crossroad and you ask yourself, who do I love? And it is, I love God and I love others. And you think, those are the two greatest commandments, right? Love the Lord your God and what you love your neighbor as yourself. And what you're seeing on this, the challenge that you're seeing is that clients are going through this cycle over and over and over again. We all do over and over and over again. And we choose the wrong path. Now, the thing that's interesting to me is that when Jesus was having the conversation with Peter, do you remember that? And Peter had denied Jesus three times. So Peter was looking at Jesus and he was longing for Jesus. The tempter came and the question was, who do you love? And when Peter was sitting there by the fire, who did he love? Himself. He loved himself. And that led him down a path of losing. But you know, it's interesting because when Jesus came and restored Peter, do you remember when Jesus came and restored Peter? What did he do? He asked him three times, what? Do you love me? And Peter says, yes, yes, yes. Three times, completeness. He took him down that path again. He looked in Jesus' eyes. He longed for Jesus standing right in front of him. And Jesus said, who do you love? And he said, I love you. See, we have an opportunity to break this cycle with our clients. But in order to do that, in order to put them on a path for greatness, we have to help them see what they're actually doing. And in order to put myself on a path for greatness, in order for you to put yourself on a path for greatness, you have to realize what you're doing. Now, the second key to true greatness I talked about was this notion of linking discipline and desire. You know, there's a saying which I love, discipline, not desire, determines one's destiny. Now just take that in. Discipline, not just desire, determines one's destiny. You see, if you have a person who has a lot of desire but no discipline, they're going to end up on the same couch with the person who has a lot of discipline but no desire. So you've got to link discipline and desire together in order to put yourself on a path to greatness. You know, Galatians 5:4 says, those who belong to Christ, Jesus Christ, crucify the flesh with his passions and desires. You see, we have to have the right desires and not those that are linked to the flesh, which are self-focused, but we have to have those desires that are linked to the Spirit, which are other-centered. 2 Timothy 1:7 says, for the Spirit God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline. And you see, these two verses link together this notion of discipline and desire. And another way I kind of talk about this, to just give you sort of a visual that I found has worked very, very well in my own life and when I've been talking to other folks, is analogy of sort of driving. You're driving a car, and let's imagine that you're driving a Jeep, rather, and you're in a deep, deep rut. And in this rut, you can't seem to get your car out. Now, you got two choices. You can either push on the gas. Thank you. I'm not a pastor, so I didn't bring a hanky. But I do have a wife. That's which is good. You're in this deep, deep rut, and you're trying to get yourself out of that path. If all you do is push on the gas pedal, what is that going to do? That's going to keep you moving. If you move, you're going to move in the direction that you don't want to go. But you're going to do it very quickly. Now, you could say, I'm not going to push on the gas. I'm just going to use the steering wheel. Well, if you just use the steering wheel, that'll turn you, right? That'll turn you, but you won't have the power to get out. But if you use the gas and you use the steering wheel, that's how you get out of the rut. Now, you've got clients that are coming to you in that kind of situation. Have you seen that? A repeat client that comes to you again? Well, that's the reason why. They're not linking discipline and desire. If they're not linking discipline and desire, they're not going to be on the path to greatness. So let me close. You know, one of the great joys that I've had, you know, coming to this conference is meeting wonderful people. And I remember one of the first conferences that I came to when I was newly minted president of CareNet. I met with Ann Pearson. Many of you may know Ann. And in 1973, she and her husband, Jim, started a ministry called the House of His Creation, which is a maternity home for women in crisis. And she told me a story about a young woman who was white and became pregnant by a black man. And what she told me was that her father, the woman's father, was so upset that she stripped this young lady naked, that he stripped this young lady naked, painted her black, and threw her out of the house. After a neighbor let her in, she made her way to Jim and Ann's ministry. And some of you may have known Jim. He's a father figure to many, many young women and hundreds of vulnerable young women over the years. And Ann told me, you know, that he died of cancer in 2012. And after his death, his family created a book called A Father's Heart to memorialize Jim's thoughts and values. The foreword says these words, Jimmy Pearson exemplified the heart of God. He did not expect anything in return, anything short of love. He was a man's man with a heart of gold. one not afraid to love and invest in others at the expense of himself. His oldest daughter, Holly, wrote, He's one of the loves of my life, one of the greatest gifts God has ever given me. And here's what Anne wrote about him. As he fought his final battle with cancer, he was so aware of everyone around him, praying for them and telling them that he loved them. He died July 1, 2012. I kissed him on his forehead and said, "Thank you for choosing me." Now, I doubt they'll be that they were heads of state at Jimmy Pearson's funeral. They probably won't be any streets named after him. Probably won't be any statues or monuments. Nope. Just a legacy, a godly legacy in the hearts and the minds of his wife, his children, and countless other ones that he received like a little one. And it's also no doubt in my mind that when he entered the Lord's presence, he heard these, the greatest of words, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." You see, Jimmy Pearson was a great man. He protected the vulnerable. He chose the right path. He lived a disciplined life committed to pursuing the desires God had given him. And he was deeply connected to God's Spirit. You see, a legacy is not something that you leave. It's something that you live every day. Let me say that again. A legacy is not something that you leave. It's something that you live every day. So my encouragement to you is that you decide today to leave a great legacy. And I want to encourage you as you serve God and as you serve others, as you invest in the lives of others, as you receive the little ones, to be great. Seek God's purpose for your life. Be great. It's never too early or too late to be great. See, the truest measure of any person's life, and the truest measure of the greatness of anyone's life, is not what they do for themselves, but what they do for others. Amen? Have a great conference. Take care.